The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The biggest single group we have ever seen during our border coverage crossed illegally into El Paso, Texas right now. Take a look at this. This was Sunday night in El Paso. An enormous migrant caravan of well over 1,000 people crossed illegally into El Paso last night. El Paso media reporting it is potentially the biggest mass crossing in the city's history, potentially at least in decades. And you can see from this video, wave after wave after wave of hundreds of these migrants just walking across the river and then gathering on the U.S. side of the river. They form a single file line, which you'll see in the video, at some points goes as far as the eye can see.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, pretty amazing, right? The largest migrant group crosses the border. That was, I believe, Fox News making that report from the U.S.-Mexican border yesterday, showing footage of some of the largest caravans, groups, if you will, of migrants crossing the border at one time. It's pretty amazing what we're seeing. Yeah, my heart goes out to them, too, because I've seen footage of them being processed, then ultimately being shipped around the country. And these people are now sleeping on the streets, right? What do you do? You know, it's, down in El Paso, Texas, there's been a huge surge of people crossing the border illegally from Mexico. And in fact, it's so large that it has overwhelmed a 1,000-person facility that the Border Patrol set up to be sure that people, you know, weren't detained outside. So there are about 700 people waiting outside of it in, you know, really what are near freezing temperatures. I mean, think about that. And the city itself reported the Border Patrol, they caught, I think, 5,000 people, mostly from Ecuador and Nicaragua. But they've been releasing most of them onto the streets. Other reports indicate that there have been as many as maybe 10,000 people crossing over from Ciudad Juarez just the last couple days. And they are expecting even larger numbers to come. Again, we take for granted what we have here. I mean, we live in the greatest nation in the world. The United States of America is the modern-day Roman Empire. You know, our reach spans, our treasury is deep, our military is strong. We are a land of abundance. And everybody wants to come to America, the land of opportunity, home of the free and the brave, right? My heart does go out. This is a tough, tough issue. As a nation, we have a right to a sovereign border and law and order and a way of processing these people. And I think opening our border is compromising our country on a couple of levels. I mean, there's this just this influx of poison crossing our border called fentanyl, right? Drug cartels. I just spoke the last week about human trafficking, children, women being sold into sexual slavery. There's more slavery today in the year 2022 than there was 1,000 years ago, if you can believe that, 2,000 years ago. It's unbelievable the numbers that we are now seeing. So for those reasons, I think we really need to get a grip on our border. But yet my heart on the other side of this, and I say this all the time, it goes out for the person that looks across that border and sees the United States of America and what it represents and what they possibly can have. And I do believe people have a right to migrate. So it's a difficult, difficult issue. I think we're going to be talking a lot more about it in the days ahead because I think those numbers are going to continue to increase. And we're going to continue to see how the cartels and other nefarious forces are using our porous and relatively open border to exploit the human person and to profit off of the drug trade. I think it was Monsignor James Shea who was with me last week, and he says the number one source of illegal activity is drug trafficking. Second is guns. And then third is human trafficking, which is always pretty striking to me. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on that. Senator Joe Manchin, by the way, he's the Democrat from Virginia, West Virginia. He joined a number of Texas Republicans. He joined Senator John Cornyn and Representative Tony Gonzalez in a letter actually to the president, asking the president, hey, you need to extend Title 42. So what's Title 42? It basically restricts the flow of illegal immigrants across the southern border. And the Texas Democrat down there, Henry Cuellar, he joined the letter as well. Those who are down on the border, you know, they're seeing a much different picture than you might if you're living in Minnesota or maybe Chicago or in Rhode Island or somewhere in California. Very, very different world. The Biden administration has faced, I think it's fair to say increasing bipartisan opposition I think this is not a partisan issue, or at least it shouldn't be. And I think now that the administration is beginning to see this, the Biden administration, of course, made a very controversial decision to end Title 42 on December 20th. So you are looking literally days away. And I saw footage of migrants on the other side, right? They're camped out. They're counting down the days. They're saying, okay, 6 days from now, I'm going to come across. And things will radically, radically change at that point in time. So there is the sand's draining through the hourglass right now in terms of what the administration will do and what we might see in the not-too-distant future. But speaking of Senator Manchin, and I know people either love or hate him. Sometimes you love him and hate him, right, depending on where he is. He was asked recently whether or not he's going to remain in the Democrat Party. And him and Senator Sinema have been a real thorn in the Democrat agenda. His answer couldn't have, I think, been very reassuring to the party. He was asked, I think it was CNN that asked him this a little bit earlier this week, whether or not he'll stick around. This was his response.
I'll look at all of these things. I've always looked at all those things. But I have no intention of doing anything right now. I mean, whether I do something later, I can't tell you what the future's going to bring. I can only tell you where I am and my mindset and what I want to accomplish in it, as long as I'm here in the Senate. I want to work with Kirsten every day, the same as I had before.
Now, Manchin, like Sinema, is also up for re-election in 2024. He told me that he has not yet made a decision about whether or not to run again.
Yeah, I don't know if you could hear all those, a little echoey. So I'll give you the one real line that stands out to me in that. You know, are you going to run again? And he says, well, whether I do something later, I can't tell you what the future is going to bring. I can only tell you where I am and my mindset at the moment. And if he does, he'll follow, as he was mentioning, another senator, the senator from Arizona, Senator Kirsten Sinema. She left Democrats, right? She left them to vote as an independent. And Sinema is she's been a strong supporter of abortion, though, and she supports redefining marriage as well, unfortunately. Manchin, on the other hand, he's going to get a lot of backlash from his West Virginia constituency if he did the same thing. So we'll see what happens. I think the guy's been relatively fair. You know, he's got His role is to represent his constituency, right? That's what he's there, to be the voice of his people. I think he's kept them first and foremost. You know, he hasn't sold out on a lot of different issues. I think he's made some bad decisions. I think he's been compromised on a few, but that's a whole other story. We'll see what happens with him. You see what has happened with Kirsten Sinema already. The world of politics is weird, isn't it? It makes strange bedfellows, as they say. And, boy, things will be getting even stranger in the months ahead as we get closer to those generals. Donald Trump, do you love him or hate him? Are you going to vote for Donald? He threw his hat in the ring. Where do you stand on the former president? Huh? Do you think he has a shot? Recent polls show that the former president is not getting the love he used to get. I was watching some footage of right after the election, after Biden had won and Trump had lost, and people waving the Trump flags and the American flags, and you know, people would have wanted him right back in. But with time, I think things do cool a little bit. Voters were asked about a face-off between Donald Trump and President Biden. And 47% chose Biden to Trump. I mean, again, I don't know who they interview. And you may not like either candidate, but really? I mean, look at the liberal and immoral agenda that the Biden administration is putting forth. Look at the economy. Look where you were, as they say, 2 years ago versus where you are today. Go through that. You might hate Trump, but I don't see Trump facing off against against Biden, because I think Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, I think he's going to throw his hat in the ring. And Republican voters, when they polled them as well, chose DeSantis 56% to Trump's 33%. So you might not see a Biden-Trump head-to-head. Instead, you might see Biden-DeSantis. And DeSantis, when they put that matchup, Trump or DeSantis to Biden, DeSantis beat Biden by 7 points. And perhaps that poll is what's driving whatever, you know, Trump's going to announce tomorrow. Trump's supposed to make an announcement. Did you hear about that? I don't know if Maggie's aware of that or not. You know, he's going to make some big announcement. Maybe he's going to pull out. Maybe he's not. I don't know. I can't see him doing that. But we'll see. Big announcement from Donald Trump tomorrow. And, of course, I'll bring it to you. I'll let you know what's happening there. Speaking of world leaders, how about the Pope? We'll talk about him for just a second. I mean, this is kind of cool. You know, Twitter's gotten a lot of attention with all the dumps that they've been giving, the intel dumps on, you know, the bias and the infiltration by the FBI and the partnership with the Democratic Party and a lot of these other things. Well, Twitter, on Monday, it actually marked the 10th anniversary of the Pope having an official account on Twitter, on their social site. December 12, 2012, the Feast of Our Lady Guadalupe, Pope Benedict tweeted out, "Dear friends, I am pleased to get in touch with you through Twitter. Thank you for your generous response. I bless all of you from my heart." End of quote. Since then, the account has accumulated, check this out, more than 53 million followers. That's pretty big. Mostly on the English and the Spanish, you know, language channels. But during the pandemic, Pope Francis, his tweets were received, or they were viewed, I should say, by more than 20. They were viewed more than 27 billion times. Not that there's followers, but his tweets received 27 billion views. And one final story. This made me proud to be Catholic. Heisman Trophy winner Caleb Williams, he told the audience at the ceremony that he credited his time at Gonzaga College High School in Washington, D.C. with showing him how to be a man for others, right? And he told his coach, he says, "Coach, you may not know this, but Gonzaga's mantra that you drilled into us, men for others, well, it's helped inspire me to create the Caleb Cares Foundation, which is all about giving back. So thank you, Coach. Thank you, Gonzaga." I love it. I love it. Maggie, we saw that piece the other day, and I forget who was that was on doing an interview, and they asked about the royal family. Remember that? And he goes, "Oh, do you remember the story?"
That was the coach of the Celtics.
And he says, "Well, the royal family, there's only one royal family, right?"
He goes, "Jesus, Mary, and Joseph." And the reporter's like, "No.
This is,
yeah." He's like, "Sorry, that's the only royal family I know."
I love it. I love it. I love the ways you would use your platform to witness. Great, great stuff. Hey, you know, I came across an article, and I want to talk about this for a moment because I do believe prayer changes things, right? And you know, I've had the great privilege of being able to travel throughout Europe and really around the world. And when you see some of these great monasteries of the past just withering to time, overridden, and falling into disuse and decay, it gives me pause. And there was an article that I came across recently called "What We Lose with the Decline of Monastic Life." And I think it's more than just the buildings, right? There is a spiritual component to this as well. You know, here in the United States, there are places where religious life is actually growing. There's a lot of good news out there. Clear Creek Abbey in Oklahoma is an example, along with St. Michael's Abbey in Southern California, and so are the Dominican Sisters of St. Cecilia, otherwise known as the Nashville Dominicans. But these and other religious orders and congregations are growing so much that they've actually had to build new convents and monasteries. Now, unfortunately, they're the exception rather than the rule. For the most part, monastic, you know, life is in decline in our country and really in other places around the world. And with that decline, we as the church, we lose something. It's not just the church. It's the whole world, really, that loses something. The monastic life isn't meant to just close out the world and let people inside the walls and concentrate on becoming saints through this monastic life, you know, of prayer and discipline and sacrifice. No, it's meant to be a witness that there is a whole lot more to life than this rat race that so many people are involved in, you know? And how much money can we put in our account? How many initials do we have after our name? You know, how many vacations can I take? It doesn't matter. You step inside a monastery or a convent, you pray in the chapel, you sense a completely different atmosphere. I felt it in a lot of places. I mean, I like to say it's as if though the veil that separates heaven and earth is just a little thinner there. There's something, I don't know, of the divine, really. I'm joined today by Brother Levin Harton. He is the prior and director of vocations for the Benedictine Abbey in Atchison, Kansas, and they're the ones who sponsor Benedictine College. My colleague here, Peter Atkinson, he leads the Merry Beggars. He's been on the show many times. We'll hear from him again probably next week. He just had a brother that entered that monastery to begin his discernment period. And you know, the way Peter put it, I was standing next to him. He says he's entered a monastery that he'll probably never leave. He'll spend the rest of his life. Kind of amazing call. God is calling out. Maybe he's calling to you. Hey, Brother Levin, thank you for joining me tonight. It's good to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks, Drew. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly. I am delighted to have you here. You know, I saw this article. I don't know if my producer sent it to you or not, on the decline of monastic life or what happens when we lose monastic life. Let's talk a little bit about it. St. Benedict, of course, started the whole movement in the West, and when he left Rome behind because of all its, you know, decadence, you know, what purpose did it serve historically, and why is it so important today?
Yeah, you know, so you could have a monastic historian come in and really clarify the origins of monasticism, but I'll give you just a 30-second view of it. St. Benedict left Rome, as you said, to avoid the decadence, really in a kind of a charismatic movement. You had Christianity legal after the persecutions. And so these Christians were leaving the city life where the practice of the faith was becoming diluted, watered down, less interesting, less dynamic, less filled with the Spirit. And they went out to the desert to seek a place where they would have no distraction, where they could live an ascetic life and know the Lord deeply and intimately, and really did it in some sense for a quote-unquote selfish purpose. Yeah. But it was because they were so enamored with and aware of the surpassing value of heaven and the foretaste that we get of it in this life that they were willing to sacrifice all these other things and go live it and live what they called a white martyrdom, as opposed to the red martyrdom of the persecutions. It was a white martyrdom, giving up life, giving up this earthly life and its pleasures to anticipate and to live arched toward the afterlife and an eschatological witness. Yeah. That witness was at the origin, and that curiosity and that desire was at the origin of monastic life, to experience that for oneself, whether that be as a hermit or in communal life and as a Cenobite.
Yeah.
So St. Benedict was part of that movement.
So, you know, in terms of what it does for the individual, I totally get that. One thing that people don't realize is what it does, what it does do for the universal church and what it does for the world at large. I often think that some of these monasteries and these convents where there is this deep prayer, this deep union with the Lord, yeah, I think there are graces that flow that hold back the justice of God, which I think this planet, you know, rightly deserves. The spiritual dynamic. Talk about that for a moment. What benefit does monastic life offer to those on the other side of the wall?
Yeah. No, so I think some of your language, as you were speaking just a moment ago, the witness of escaping the rat race, gets at what I think is really primary in the monastic life and its effect on the culture. Specifically, the arrangement of our life around the liturgy and the sanctification of the day. It can be very provocative for people. And as you said, when they step into a monastic liturgy that's well ordered, that where the ministers are extremely attentive to the music, to the setting, to the pacing, to the uniformity, to the really digging into the riches of the Catholic tradition, of our liturgical tradition, putting that forward to the church as a sign of heaven, as a witness of the life to come, and inviting others into it. Invites this a preference for the spiritual over the natural, the supernatural over the natural, and getting to ultimately to the heart, getting back to the heart. The world is full of distraction. You know, monasteries can be full of distraction too nowadays with smartphones and internet services, right?
Yeah.
If there's not good parameters, but distraction rules the day in so many ways. The monastic life brings us back to a mindfulness and awareness. Through discipline and through silence and through like humble service to one another.
Yeah.
The witness of a well-functioning monastic community offers a beautiful witness of reverence for the other, of reverence for God, and of, again, the supernatural values over the earthly values.
You know, I could not agree with you more. And as I said, I think that there are special graces that come. You're intercessors for the world. You're interceding before the throne of God for humanity as well, and I just I think His mercy flows as a result of your presence in the world and your sacrifice and your offering. Take me through your day. Now, for those who are listening, they're saying, well, what's a monk do all day? What time do you get up? What's your routine like? People envision you as just praying all day. That's, I know, not the case, but right. take us through your day. What's it like in monastic life?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So each monastery, one of the unique features of monastic life is that each house is autonomous, right? And so the local abbot is the superior of the ordinary, and he determines what the days look like. And so Clear Creek Abbey, our Abbey, St. Michael's Abbey, we'll have different, slightly different days, but generally they'll follow the same trajectory. For us at St. Benedict's Abbey, our bell goes off at 5:25 a.m. every morning, and we wake up and then we go and we do a set of liturgical prayers together first, and then it flows into continued house silence for us to have private time for Lectio Divina, the reading of sacred scripture and knowing the Lord intimately in our private prayer. That silence will last until after 7:30 a.m., and we have breakfast in silence for those who would like that meal. And by that time, we roll into our day of our activity of work, whatever that could be. And since we're a pretty active community, our congregation of monasteries has been associated with active works, really due to our origin, our foundation in the 1850s. Yeah. The American church was still growing, and we were growing with it. We were contributing to that pastoral demand. So for us, that could mean that a monk goes and teaches classes and has office hours at the college or at our high school.
Yep.
A monk who's a student would go do studies. A monk like me who's prior would probably have meetings and scheduling stuff for that period. But we do that until about 11:30. And at 11:30, we come back and have midday prayers at 11:45. And then right after that, we have a 10-minute break and then Mass. And at that Mass, we'll invite 120 students and people from the local college area come and join us for our conventual Mass.
Yeah.
We have lunch following that, and then another period of work. And then in the evening time, we have, again, community prayer for Vespers at 5 p.m., where we chant the Psalms, and then a time for private prayer again, private Lectio Divina with the yeah. God.
That's
followed
awesome.
By dinner.
Wow.
Yeah, and then compline, and then we go to bed.
Wow. And it starts all over again the next day. Wow, it sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it's a rhythm of work and prayer.
I love it. I only have a moment or two left, and there may be a man who's listening right now who feels this calling. And what would you recommend? Is there a resource or a place that he can go to say, you know, I feel God's putting this on my heart, but I want to learn more?
Yeah, so there's so many good websites. Bishop Barron's Word on Fire website, Relevant Radio. I'm sure you all have great materials. Our website is kansasmonks.org. Right. And we have a special vocations website, monkvocations.org. But the primary thing that I would want for any guy who's really considering discerning is to step back from multimedia use and to invest more time in prayer and ask, what do I really desire? That was crucial for me when I was discerning to step back from a life of noise, just so that I could hear myself and start to uncover my interior and understand it.
Well said. Well, brother, do me a favor. Remember us in your prayers. If you would do that, we'd be grateful, and all those who are now listening. And in about a half an hour, we'll be praying the Chapel of the Divine Mercy across the country and really around the world with a lot of other people. So we'll remember you and your brothers, and you'll be deeply in our prayers as well, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, too. It's good to have you here. That's Brother Levin Harton. He's the prior and the director of vocations at the Benedictine Abbey in Atchison, Kansas. I just, I thought it'd be, a great conversation to have him here as we're seeing monastic life in decline. Why? And what's it cost the world? Let's pray for them. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Today, we're here to talk about fusion, combining two particles into one. Last week, at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, scientists at the National Ignition Facility achieved fusion ignition. And that is creating more energy from fusion reactions than the energy used to start the process. It's the first time it has ever been done in a laboratory, anywhere in the world. Simply put, this is one of the most impressive scientific feats of the 21st century.
You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I'm a geek. When I heard that, I said, what's it mean for the future? Let's look at it. One of the most significant breakthroughs of the 21st century, the U.S. Department of Energy announced today a monumental milestone in nuclear fusion. In their research, they have what they're calling a net energy gain. It was achieved for the first time in history by scientists at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. What's this mean for the oil industry? Now, look, we are a long way off from really being able to somehow use this on a large scale. But it is the first step. And it made me think back in, I don't know if you ever saw the Spider-Man series, 2004, Spider-Man 2 came out, Tobey Maguire. There's that title role with, I think he was in that role, and Alfred Molina played the role of Otto Octavius. He was a scientist who developed fusion energy, the ability to basically replicate power of the sun. Unfortunately for Otto, his experiment went awry. So did he did. But this is an iteration of the dream that scientists have had of chasing after that for decades. You know, nuclear fusion energy. Our current nuclear energy uses fission. And that's just where atoms are knocked against each other and the resulting energy spike is captured. But fusion, on the other hand, just so you can understand it, it fuses the atoms together, which is what happens in the sun and in other stars, and then it becomes self-sustaining. So the problem for scientists is getting the fusion process to start, because it requires a ton of energy, far more energy normally than you would get out of it, right? So there's no net gain. Well, they were able to do that now. These, as I said, the scientists at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, they have for the very first time gotten more energy out of the fusion process than they actually put in. And this is, well, it's being hailed as a major breakthrough towards having clean, sustainable, cheap energy. It's going to be amazing. I don't know whether I'll see it. Maybe my children or my children's children one day will have a whole new reality. So if science is able to make this reproducible and then replicate it, let's say, on a local level, it's going to have profound ramifications for the whole world. It'd be a major disruption to the coal industry, to the oil industry, along with natural gas. Think about those countries like Venezuela or Saudi Arabia or the Middle East. What would it do to those nations? It also would raise, I think, a lot of questions about how we get this energy to the rest of the world. Who controls the technology? Do we as the U.S. hold on to this technology for ourselves? Do we export it? You know, what do we do? You know, I think oil-producing countries are going to find themselves on the short end of the stick. But I also wonder, you know, if I was an oil-producing country, I'd pay billions of dollars to whoever did this and then shut the patent down, right? That's what some people try to do, to own the patents so the technology can't be used. But that's not going to happen. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent here. Let me bring into the conversation a professor of physics and astronomy at Vanderbilt University. His name is Robert Scherer. He researches everything from dark energy and dark matter to the start of the Big Bang and the large-scale structure of the universe. He's also the author of a quantum mechanics textbook, and you can check out his blog on the science in science fiction at cosmicyarns.com if you want to learn a little bit more. Hey, Doctor, it's good to talk with you today. Thank you for being here. Thanks for entertaining me.
Sure.
So describe this breakthrough to us, if you could. It's being described as a Kitty Hawk moment. And we know what Kitty Hawk has done, how that transformed the future. You give me maybe an understanding in lay terms, if you could, as to what this means, what's been achieved, and what it portends, perhaps, for the future.
Well, we've known for a long time you can get energy out of fusion. The problem is that atoms don't like to be fused. They repel each other. The nuclei repel each other. So you need to get up to really, really high temperatures and really, really high energies in order to make fusion work. Now, what you haven't been reading in the news is that we've actually been able to do nuclear fusion for a long time.
Oh, wow.
But it's not controlled nuclear fusion. It's called a hydrogen bomb. So to make that work, you set off an atomic bomb that heats everything up to billions of degrees, and then that lets the fusion process happen.
Wow.
So what we've been trying to do is to make that happen in a controlled environment.
which is very difficult because you need very high densities and very high temperatures, but you also don't want to blow up the thing that you're working with.
Yeah, no, it makes certainly makes sense. So I think the question that's uppermost in people's minds is, you know, what is the potential for this technology? And how long, in your opinion, you know, will it be before this can be made available? And we see clean, you know, reliable, abundant energy.
Well, we've been working on this really since the 1950s. And I remember reading articles about this laser fusion thing when I was in high school back in the 1970s. So it's been going on for a long time. The joke in physics is that fusion energy is the power source of the future, and it always will be. But I think this is a major step forward. I would be surprised if it was any less than 50 years to get anything commercial out of this. There's a lot of things that have to be done.
Would you agree it's a Kitty Hawk moment? I mean, is it on that level, this achievement?
That's a little bit of – I mean, it's a major breakthrough. I'm not sure I would call it a Kitty Hawk level because it's not a – it's really more incremental than it is, you know, revolutionary. We knew eventually or hoped eventually we would get to it. But it's a major breakthrough. I don't mean to suggest that it's not, I'm not sure it's equivalent to the invention of the airplane.
So you know, entertain me, if you will, and give me a look at what this means if this technology in 50 years or less becomes abundant and reliable, clean, cheap energy. Sounds great. What will happen to these oil-producing areas of the world? Will they transition to this technology? I mean, what's it mean for their nations?
Well,
a lot of them are funded on
I think if you know, there are huge advantages to fusion power if you could make it work, because it produces no radioactive waste, there's no meltdown danger, and the thing that you're using to make it work is hydrogen. You can get it out of seawater, so it's not like you have to go mining for some rare element. The big question, of course, is how expensive these plants would be if you could eventually commercialize them. You know, nuclear power plants are quite expensive to build. So I'm assuming these things would be quite expensive initially. But if you could make them, they would be the energy of choice for everything. I mean, there's just no real downside to it.
Right.
It would just be remarkable. And obviously, eventually, you would assume that it would drive most other forms of energy out of existence.
Yeah, I would think that you know, oil production would be, you know, relegated to a very small industry. We still need it for plastic and a lot of other things, but fundamentally, when it comes to energy, even powering a spacecraft or other things along those lines, the potential is pretty broad. Let's take a call or two for you. My guest today, Dr. Robert Scherer, if you want to join us, 888-914-9149. Todd is listening in Lexington, Kentucky. Todd, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. I just recently retired from an auto manufacturing facility here in Kentucky, and they, you know, everybody's talking about EV and Toyota, certainly. Well, there you go. The company I work for, talking about battery power, but they back last year announced that they were starting to manufacture hybrid cell powertrains in our engine plant across there on the campus. I'm kind of curious your take on the viability of hydrogen cell, and is it something that will work, and can they manufacture and establish refilling type points in a timely way that it maybe push back the EV craze somewhat?
Doctor, what are your thoughts?
It's hard to know. I mean, I'm not an expert on hydrogen cell technology. You know, the problem with electric cars getting the electricity, it's the storage issue. And they're bumping up against kind of cramming as much electrical energy into a small space as you can. So it may be that the hydrogen cell cars eventually take over. It's very hard to say.
All right, Todd, I hope that answered your question.
Thank you.
All right, you got it. So you say it's about 50 years away, maybe making this.
Well, it's hard to predict the future, but it's probably farther away than, it's not like we're going to be doing this 10 years from now. I can you know, I'll make that firm prediction.
Is there any danger with this, of this somehow getting out of control, or do you have any concerns as we begin to develop this technology and make it more abundant that things could go wrong? We know about nuclear reactors with the threat of them melting down. What about this going awry?
It's really much safer. You can't really make any kind of weapon out of it. I mean, it has the property that if it, you know, with a nuclear reactor, it can melt down if it malfunctions. But if this malfunctions, the only thing that would happen is it would shut down. Right. It just wouldn't function. So there's not any real danger from it. I mean, the lasers they use in this particular technology are very powerful, but you're not going to find people just walking off with one of them.
Yeah. So how does this work with the technology? Just kind of a final thought on this. I mean, U.S. has this breakthrough. Do we share this information with the rest of the world? Do we want to develop it ourselves? Do we see it as an economic potential? What happens next, and how does that work?
Well, I think, first of all, there actually are two approaches. The one that is in the news now is laser fusion, where you blast a little pellet with an enormous number of powerful lasers, and it fuses. It may be that the approach that works better is magnetic confinement fusion, where you have gas inside of what's called a tokamak. And that's already an international effort. We're part of an international consortium to harness that, and that's also been going on for many years. I think the technology is not going to be secret. Everybody knows how it works. The question of building it is really the hard part.
Well, fascinating stuff. I'm grateful for your time and for your expertise. We'll see what comes from this. It's being hailed as a Kitty Hawk moment. I thought, wow, we should at least dive into it and see if all the hype is true. Hey, thank you for the balance, Doctor. Great to talk with you today. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's my delight. That's Dr. Robert Scherer, and you can check out his blog on the science in science fiction at CosmicYarns.com, a professor of physics and astronomy at Vanderbilt University. It's almost 15 minutes before the top of the hour. I have to take a really short pause. I'll be back on the other side. Stay with me. You'll find what I'm going to share with you. A little bit out of this world. In fact, Maggie just put it on my radar, and I thought, that can't be true. I'll tell you what she just told me when we come back.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, live, coming up. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we'll pray in about 12 minutes. Can't wait to do that. Looking forward to it. Praying for you and with you. It's one of the highlights of my day. Hey, before we move on, I was just sitting here in the studio, and I was just thinking, you know, about this so-called Kitty Hawk moment with this breakthrough in fusion technology. And, you know, I think about how young our country is, right? 200 plus years. And you take a look at what the United States of America has created and has developed. It started with our new form of government, right? This great experiment in ordered liberty. You know, this democratic republic that we have. You take a look at not just our form of government, the cotton gin or Henry Ford, you know, coming up with the internal combustion engine or the assembly line. Or we spoke about Kitty Hawk, right? How about the Wright brothers and flight, right? Look at how that has transformed the world. From there, we put a man on the moon. We were the first people to be able to do that. Of course, the internet and so many other type of inventions. I did a quick search during the break and came up with the top 20 famous American inventions. And I didn't know that we created the Ferris wheel. I would have thought that was done in France or some other place. Dental floss, hearing aids, cardiac defibrillators, I can believe, radiocarbon dating, right? How about traffic lights, crash test dummies, microwave ovens, assembly lines? That, of course, changed things. Lasers, right? Light-emitting diodes, those are LEDs. You know, your TV's an LED, I bet. How about global positioning systems, GPS? Where would you be without your cell phone getting you around or the GPS in your car, right? chemotherapy, video games, email, right? The internet, personal computers. I mean, just those things. How about, we'll just take a few of those. How about flight, right? And where that has led us. How about the creation of the personal computer, how that has revolutionized the world and what can be done in terms of sharing knowledge and computation and so many other things. The internet, how it has connected the world, how it has created new industries. It's just amazing. And the list goes on and on. So I'm proud to be an American. And once again, here we are with this story of this fusion energy breakthrough. U.S. Department of Energy announcing earlier today. They're calling it a Kitty Hawk moment. Pretty cool stuff. You know, Maggie was saying something to me during the last break. She came across a story. It's kind of weird. And I'm like, you know what? But I'll share it with you just because it's one of these days. We've had a weird first hour here, right? From monastic life to to fusion energy breakthroughs. Maggie, why not throw this in the mix, right? You want to share what you saw, or at least what's being reported?
Yeah, I saw part of a podcast with Eric Metaxas and Roger Stone from yesterday. And Roger Stone has worked in and around the White House for a while. And he claimed that there's a demonic portal in the sky.
And this is Roger Stone who says this.
This is Roger Stone. He says that there's a demonic portal that has opened above the White House.
Wow.
I was like, wait, what? But he goes on to like explain, he like sends a cop friend of his down to like investigate this. The cop calls him and he's thinking this guy's going to call him back and be like, yeah, there's nothing there. But he calls and he says, there's so many people around trying to take pictures of this thing. And you can see it better at night than you can see it during the day. But there's like definitely like a weird little like cluster of things.
So it's not an astronomical, you know, or atmospheric anomaly.
He says in it, he's like, I thought that maybe it was, there's some sort of like reflection.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
It was an aerostat balloon. Maybe there's some sort of logical explanation for it. But he comes
he
out.
He calls it a demonic
he
portal.
He says it's a demonic portal.
Yeah, so my first reaction is it's something in the atmosphere or it's something military that the government has over
right.
the White House for monitoring or doing whatever. But again, you got a person who should be relatively rational making a statement like that. And it made me think when you said that a few minutes ago, just about the history of the White House. And there's some interesting, and again, I'm just throwing this out there because it's kind of a crazy day. I'll share this stuff with you. You know, I like to go down these rabbit holes. A number of the founding fathers, they say, starting with George Washington himself, belonged to Masonic lodges, right? And we've talked about Freemasonry in the past. The same has been true of presidents since that time. You know, of 45 different presidents, 46, I think 14 of them, maybe 15 have been Masons. That's about a third of presidents who've been Freemasons. Outside of that, there can be spirits. I mean, think about this place of power. Think of what this can do. I mean, look at the evil that's coming out of the administration right now with the Disrespect for Marriage Act and with, you know, the culture of death and with, you know, gender and all these other issues. I go back to what happened. Unless this place has been exercised or cleaned or blessed, I worry about influences in the place. Abraham Lincoln participated in at least one White House seance. So there was a seance. When you open the doors, you give Satan, you give the demons legal territory. They had mediums in there conjuring spirits. And this was in that era when spiritualism was sweeping the United States. There was an author, a guy named Mitch Horowitz, who wrote this. He says, indeed, the robust growth of the occult and mystical movements can be traced through the 19th century America, aided by the influence of Freemasonry and Transcendentalism. That helped to transform the young nation into a laboratory of religious experiments and a launching pad for revolutions in the alternative and New Age spirituality that eventually swept the world. In the early 20th century, he says, the new spiritual therapies from meditation to mind-body healing to motivational thinking began to revolutionize how religion was understood in contemporary times, not only as a source of salvation, but as a means of healing. In this sense, occult America changed the world. So from this area, this is what he says. But look, go back. We can take a look at others. You know, President Franklin Roosevelt, he personally oversaw placement of that eye and pyramid on the back of the dollar. You ever see that on the dollar? It's a pyramid with an eye in the middle of it, along with that Latin maxim, God smiles in our new order of the ages. That's what that means. Gerald Ford was a Mason. It was unfortunately because the very first Europeans to establish permanent settlements in North America, they were devout Catholics, right? Maryland. Maryland was a Catholic colony. Jimmy Carter, speaking of weird anomalies over the White House, right? He spoke of witnessing a UFO, right? And his CIA deployed psychics to obtain information through clairvoyance. So Jimmy Carter, he told a group of Emory University students one time that during his presidency, clairvoyant spies helped to identify the coordinates of a crashed Soviet spy plane in Central Africa, netting a very significant intelligence gain. I believe that. It sounds wacky. Satan, you know, these demonic spirits clearly could know where that plane went down. They can clearly give that type of information to these so-called clairvoyants. But what happens now? You've got the president of the United States believing in this type of stuff. You've got people who have opened themselves up to dark spirits, and it just can really become a very dangerous area, not just for the clairvoyants, but even for this country. There was a very famous psychic named Uri Geller, who's been used by various intelligence agencies since the early 1970s. He may still be, I don't know. But it's this evolution of occultism, right, that is, I think, very intriguing. The first ESP lab in the U.S., the first ESP lab was at Drake University. You know, Ronald Reagan was a keen follower of astrology. It was reported that some of the president's actions were based on charts. So it goes on. Hillary Clinton had a number of New Age advisors. I'll tell you more about it. Let me see if I can sneak a call in while we have time. Alexia is listening in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Alexia.
Hi, I'm just digging into my brain. I know Mary Lincoln had somebody in the White House with a crystal ball quite a few times.
Yep.
Around Lincoln's, you know, situation, you know, the assassination. I also have an old movie, One Step Beyond. You ever heard of that series?
No, I haven't.
Back in the late 50s, kind of like the Twilight Zone, but it's all fact. It was all investigated. And apparently Lincoln had a dream and saw himself in the casket. He went into the, you know, where they had the casket where it sits in you know, what is that place? You know, like in the White House. And apparently he looked down in his dream and he saw himself dead.
Well.
But that's not, but, it, and also Reagan's wife, she was also into Jean Dixon.
Yeah, that's right. No, I forgot about that.
After, I think, I don't remember if it was after the assassination attempt or what. And also I heard Donald Trump's wife, she's Catholic, went into the White House and blessed that and cleaned that house up because of the darkness of that of the White House from other
good
leaders.
For Melania. Alexia, thank you. I got to leave it right there. You're right. Nancy Reagan was a keen follower of astrology and, Melania Trump, I did hear, I think, brought a priest in to bless the place because there was hauntings in the White House. They claim, a lot of visitors claim to have experienced ghosts. Now, are they really ghosts or are they demonic spirits? Even people say that, you know, Lincoln's bedroom was haunted. We'll see. We'll see. But, if Melania brought a good Catholic priest in and blessed that place, thank God. The White House certainly needs it. I think it needs another cleansing, doesn't it? Let's pray when I come back, okay? I hear the bumper running. We'll pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. You can get in if you want at 888-914-9149. Don't go away.